Part 5 is over, but here on Posher Recaps, we are just getting started. My name is Ariel, and I am joined, as always, by my co-pilot. It's Rich. What's up, Rich?
What is up? I'm very glad to be here with you, flying in the right seat, I guess. Yeah, we got our sheepskin. We're ready to go.
That's all that matters, is that we know which one of us is doing what.
Yeah, right.
As long as the navigator behind us knows what he's doing, we should be fine. Yeah, part 5. So now at this point, we are just over the halfway point of the 9-episode total. So that's noteworthy. How'd you feel about this episode coming out of it, part 5?
It felt like a much more straightforward episode, right? We had a lot more actual combat. We were in the air, but it felt like we were really dealing with a lot of the fallout that we discussed last time in terms of the uncertainty, right? The like off-screen death of so many of our characters that I think we walked away from feeling a little unsatisfied, but it even more so now, to me, Ariel, feels like such an intentional choice on the part of the authors to like root us in the perspective of these pilots, because this is the experience that they had with the men around them, you know. When you start like reading about the casualty rates, like the Air Force, they lost 26,000 casualties over the course of the war. It's more than the Marines. That's more than like any other division of the American armed forces in World War II. You know, we've heard it already in the episodes, but the rate of mission completion is less than 50% in the 100th. And now in episode 5, we see it. They fly 17 planes. One comes back. And you and I have been pretty critical of like the lack of clarity on the kind of context of some of what's going on. But this is only 2 days after episode 4. Buck Egan's plane like drops out of the sky. We lose all those people off screen. That's October 8th. October 10th, Bucky Cleveland goes and flies this mission. Rosenthal is the only plane that makes it back. This is all historically accurate, right? Of the 17 planes, the 4 have to turn back. I know I'm like getting ahead of myself, but it just... To me, I've been doing a lot of homework outside, and this was what's called Black Week. It was a major shift in perspective from the American Air Force. They flew missions every single day over the course of this week, and the Luftwaffe kicked our asses. They started to focus their strategy in a way that I don't think the episode articulates, that the Luftwaffe in the beginning dealing with the B-17s had a really hard time because they would fly in this really tight formation. We've talked about it on the show. But just the layout of the machine guns is such that when you get three of those planes tucked in tight with each other, they have this incredible field of fire around them. And it makes it really hard for the fighters to approach and knock them out of the sky. But we see it in this episode. They would hunt like predators on the Serengeti. They look for the stragglers. As soon as an engine drops and you can't keep pace, they would focus. And during this period of Black Week, the Americans are sending missions every day. Then the Luftwaffe have figured out we need to isolate individual bombing groups, and we need to create such catastrophic casualties on each of those divisions that it shatters American morale. And it worked really effectively, you know, as you're dealing with like one plane coming home. Like there's stories, Ariel, of these guys, these replacements showing up, getting sent to the 100th. And it's written in like their journals that we're looking at now, 80 years later. They just go back to their bunks and write, I'm done. There's absolutely no way I'm making it out of this war. They've put me in the bloody 100th. I'm going to die here. Right.
Yeah.
And there's just such a lack of clarity. These planes get knocked out of the sky. Like, we saw it in Band of Brothers, the Pacific. These guys are on the ground. They're trapped in the fight constantly. But when they lose each other, there's a body, right? There's clarity. Yeah. It's very clear what has happened, where these pilots, like, you have no idea. I think there was some crazy number, too, like 35,000 Air Force soldiers. This one I'm a little off on, end up prisoners of war by the end. So just the uncertainty. It like paid itself forward from episode 4. I'm off on a lot of tangents, but I just wanted to like talk about some of the context that I gave myself going into this episode that made it really satisfying for me to watch, at least.
No, I so appreciate it. And just overall, like for the record, I feel so lucky to get to listen to you provide all this extra context, because it really is, and we've talked about it before, unfortunately, you know, this is some of the stuff that we're missing, that we've seen these same, or a lot of these same, you know, showrunners in a sense, and like air quotes, give us before. And it just feels like some of this concrete information is what's missing. I think they would argue, and I'm sure they had conversations about it. I don't think like I'm saying, or you're saying something that they didn't think about in the room. They were probably like, you know, we have to strike the balance, and we don't want to give them too much information, but like, just provide the information and people will engage as much or as little as they want. I think like that's just how it should be. But hearing you give all this information really has helped me not just care so much more about some of these things, but like really understand the magnitude of these things. Like the whole thing last week with the Bloody 100th, and how that's not really a thing that they have discussed. And I understand that that's kind of more of like a historical looking backwards thing, but like, it's such a big piece of it. And I remember watching this episode so vividly, thinking about that. And like, anytime they mention the 100th, I'm like, oh my God, the Bloody 100th. Like, it's an extra layer that gives you both factual groundedness and emotional groundedness, which I think the show is in need of.
It is, you know, I mean, I think that when they talk about, I listen to a bunch of Orloff, who's the main writer that we have here for Masters of the Air, was very relevant in Band of Brothers. And he talks about the adaptations not as clean narratively as they had with the Pacific or Band of Brothers. The Pacific, they're dealing with three separate books, but they're very narrative through lines of those characters, of Lecky and Sledge especially, right? And there was a lot to draw on. Right. So this, the book that they're adapting here, Masters of the Air, it is less narratively focused, right? It is more like an accounting of the missions than the previous texts were. So it's interesting to see the way like some of that's missing in the adaptation. But I found it really pointed that like all of this is happening in a very compressed week. Like, we hear it in some of the dialogue in the episode. We've flown three missions in 3 days. Aren't they supposed to rotate us? Like, there's nobody left to rotate in and out.
Yeah. Right? Like, with who? Who are we going to rotate?
And again, like, this shift in tactics from the Luftwaffe was really profound, because they started to identify that when dealing with these B-17 formations, they couldn't attack in their traditional attack patterns. Normally they would come in from behind on these planes because they have such better acceleration. They can like overtake you, but they realized that there was like much better effective rate of lethality when they attacked from the front. The cockpit of the plane is like super vulnerable, right? Just like going back in some of the research I got, that like Bucky Cleveland flying down to North Africa, the whole nose of his plane was blown out, Ariel. Yeah. I can't believe that they like they minimized it on the show almost, but that whole glass dome with your nose gunner was gone, and they flew the length of the Alps with like the plane really ripped apart. So once the Luftwaffe like dialed it in, this was a devastating week for the American Air Forces, and especially the 100th. This one mission, this character that we meet this episode, Rosie Rosenthal, he's a really interesting guy. I'll have more to say, but this is where they get the name, the Bloody 100th. They fly 17 planes, three drop out, four drop out mechanically, one comes home, and it's Rosie Rosenthal's first mission. And it's profound, you know. I think the weight of that and the weight of those men waiting back at the base, I feel it, you know.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I think what I can say overall about the episode, to its credit, is that like it definitely felt, I think you said something similar, felt like a return to form, a return to like, okay, this doesn't feel as disjointed or mismatched of the two things that I was confusing as the previous episode. And like, I even had that theory of like, was there something that they cut out? And like, it just feels like, I don't know, a point in time where they were trying to get past so that they can get to this. And you know, in that sense it worked, but you know, there are a handful, probably all a full handful, maybe five things about the episode that I was really struck by. I felt like the music overall, I don't know if it was just that I was noticing it more, it felt elevated. It felt more pointed. I mean, some would say it manipulative, but I think to a successful degree, like there was just something about the way it was utilized in some of these very dramatic or sad or horrific moments that I was like, yes, yes, give me more of this. This is what I need. Like, this feels grand. This is what makes these moments feel larger than life, feel like you are there with them to whatever degree that's what people are feeling. So I definitely was overall kind of pleasantly surprised, because I had kind of braced myself to be disappointed again the way I had been by the fourth part.
I get it. You know, I mean, again, I think it's intentional, but that doesn't necessarily mean it was effective, right?
That's true. It
feels pretty jarring to just like lose these guys off screen, are really prominent characters. And I think, again, the challenge of like, we have a new character this week in Rosie Rosenthal, who I think is like pretty important. I don't want to like offer any spoilers as to the context of the story, but certainly historically, he's somebody that gets talked about a lot around the 100th. And so it's hard, right? We're making this transition. And I think, you know, we note the 9-episode runtime. Band of Brothers in the Pacific both got 10. So we're losing like, you know, a little bit of runway here. Pun intended, I guess, that I think like, that I think like matters.
First of all, how dare you?
I know.
That's incredible. But yes, to that point, yes. And I believe you shared that in the Discord, if I'm remembering correctly, the thing about the front of the plane, the nose being completely off, and that, you know, that already harrowing trip to Africa, like the fact that they felt like, okay, let's not make it too crazy. We need to like pull back a little.
I mean, it's one of those things of like truth is stranger than fiction almost, right? Like you can imagine them saying, no, we can't do that. Nobody will believe it, right?
Right.
We took 620.
What if one of the wings just falls off? Would it be believable?
Right. I mean, that's a whole other thing about these B-17s. Like, you know, when we look at them compared to a 747, they're not that imposing, but they were gigantic at the time. They had 100-foot wingspan. When these guys keep talking about them being rugged and you see them coming back with these holes blasted in the sides, it's because the wing was so stable. It created what they call a really stable platform for the bombing, you know, and they could get blown to hell. I mean, they could get blasted apart, and as long as the frame of the plane held together and the wing was maintained, you could mostly fly it, right? That's where it's like pretty remarkable that they keep losing these engines, but they're so heavy that you like lose speed immediately, right? Mm-hmm. There's so much coordination involved, just flying them tight in formations impossible. And then when they talk about these guys being exceptional pilots, this is what they're talking about, right? Buck Egan like gets that reputation because this guy flies 2,000 miles with the hole in the front of the plane, with the whole nose of the plane missing, right? After taking 6 20-millimeter artillery shells. And like, those are pretty big, you know? It's a lot to take in, you know?
The idea that it literally happened that way, in the sense of they could hear, the crewmen in the back could hear the captain say in the front of the plane, like, we're going to take it.
So they have like an intercom system on the plane.
Right.
Because there's like the radios, like you notice they're not radioing to one another across. The radio systems are not as like sophisticated as they have now. And you'd have all this crosstalk. Plus, you get the Germans listening to everything, right? So you can't like be giving out all your information over the airwaves. Once they're up, they're kind of static. That's why they're using those crazy flare guns to orient themselves and stuff, right? But there is an intercom in the plane. And so that beat of Buck saying, because Buck is the battalion commander. I'm misnomering it, but he was in charge of that entire mission. Mm-hmm. The guy next to him was the pilot of the plane.
So
technically the pilot of the plane can like make the call to jump.
He's in charge of the plane.
And they, you know, in the recountings of the men on that plane, they all verify it. And I mean, look, tales get taller in the telling, certainly. Mm-hmm. And when you're dealing with like heroic deeds like this, you can imagine them being kind of inflated in retrospect. But to a man, they all swear that the intercom was open, and the pilot's like, we got to bail, and actually hits the bailout button, and Buck shuts it off and says, we're not going anywhere. We're going to sit here. We're going to take it. And that the rest of the men in the plane, while it was terrifying for them that they weren't going to bail out, that it like steeled them of like, okay, we got a job to do, right? Like the commander's on the ship, he's focused. We got to like hold it up. And it's this thing that's the same as Band of Brothers, Ariel. Like, I think part of the thesis of this episode is, how do they keep getting back in the plane? Yeah. Right. We see that beat of the guy like, I'm not doing it. After they left.
When he said that, I was like, yeah, me neither. I don't want to do this.
It was a pretty significant problem, right? Like the Air Force had more psychological medical withdrawals than other elements because of this strain. But this question, how did they keep getting back in the plane? Because they do know less than 50% of the missions are successful. They know they're never going to make it to 25, but they keep getting back in, and they do it because of the other 9 guys in the plane, right? It's again, like, not that they thought they were heroes, not that they needed to go like free the, you know, the oppressed peoples or the conquered lands in Europe. They had to like hold up for the guys in the plane with them, right? They had to do their job to keep their buddy alive. And so they did it day after day, you know, and that part of it, I think, like, rings true and plays out, you know.
Incredible. Yeah, it's funny you mentioned Band of Brothers, because as soon as you said like the tall tales and the what people repeat and remember, I was just like, oh, Shades of Spears from Band of Brothers.
Yeah.
But speaking of people who survived, we ended last episode by being very confused both by what had actually happened and the choices that were made in the retelling of what had happened. But thankfully, we actually got some good news this episode. Not that Bucky cares, because he's, you know, obviously grieving his very good friend. Our boy Kroz, my heart. This is the person. I mean, I had already said that Kroz, his relationship with his friend was like the real pairing for me that I had kind of discovered this season. And for Kroz to die off camera, I was like, no, 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 my heart can't take this. I don't know. And then thankfully, because again, part of my other, girding my loins, so to speak, of this episode was like, I don't know if they got rid of Kroz. I don't know what the show expects me to do. Like, this is going to be really hard for me to stay anchored. And poor Kroz, not that he didn't, you know, not that him and everybody else who was on his plane didn't suffer, but this is a very, very welcome piece of news, certainly for the other men, but I think for the viewers as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think Crosby has been such an awesome emotional character for me to hook into. He hits me like Sledge, where he was a little underwhelming at first. Yeah. He's got that like, less heroic perspective, right? It's really relatable in terms of the fear and the anxiety and like not quite fitting in. You can empathize with him more than you can a Buck Clevens or a Bucky Egan, right? These guys are like, they're such studs, Ariel. They're so like, mm-hmm. so larger than life. They've got such swagger. It's easy to feel like disconnected from them, right? And so the Crosby promotion is a big deal. Crosby's a really relevant player in the 100th, right? And this marks like a really important transition for him in his career. And he wrote, I believe in like 1993, a biography of his experience, and talks emphatically about this notion that he emphasizes in this episode, that it becomes agonizing for him because he's got to now plot the course for the entire group, and then he's got to sit there and wait. And so every single, now it's not just about the 9 other guys on the plane with Crosby, it's all 17 planes, right? Yeah. And the weight of that responsibility becomes like pretty overwhelming for the guy. But that beat of him getting the letter from his friend at the end, oh my God, Ariel, like it crushed me. It wasn't like an effective turnaround. Just the whole goodbye that he has of like, oh yeah, like they don't even say goodbye, you know? I think it like executes so well on all of the like emotional resonance that we're talking about here, the actual impact on these men, you know?
No, for sure. I mean, to jump ahead to that just briefly, like I think it's such an effective subversion of what you're expecting. And like, he had already said to Kroz, like, oh my God, I wrote to your wife. And Kroz is like, wait, did you send the letter? And Kroz is like, no, I didn't send the letter. It's like, oh my God, thank God. Cause like, even if you send the letter right after, there's like, there's going to be a period of time where she thinks that Kroz is dead. And that's horrible. Even though obviously the intentions were good. And then for like him to be able to read the letter and find the letter, to your point, they didn't really get a goodbye. And this is like, you know, messages from the beyond, basically from his friend who's like a member of his family, who his wife like said hello to in a previous letter in the margins. Like, this is like someone who is his brother, whether blood related or not. And that moment killed me. That is probably my favorite moment in the entire, at least like emotionally, my favorite moment in the series so far. Probably, I can't think of one that like hit me harder. It's just so beautiful. I was immediately in tears. I will surprise no one. And the effectiveness of hearing the words in the voice, and then he can't even finish the letter. I mean, the letter was unfinished, so there's like a world in which that was all that was written, but like, it's so beautiful. And it makes, it stands, honestly, I hate to keep bringing this up, but it just stands in such stark contrast to the ending of last episode, where it just felt like so empty. And it was like, look, this is how you do it. You guys do know how to do it. I'm so glad.
No, I'm with you. You know, I think it's like the most emotionally effective gut punch they've created, because who can't connect with that on some level? A eulogy written about you by your best friend to your partner after your best friend has died. Yeah. And you don't get to say goodbye. Like, the layers of emotional complexity there. Yeah. Oh my God. Especially for a guy like Crosby, who has a lot of doubt, right? He does not believe in himself the way that the rest of the men around him believe. Something that I think is so interesting about Crosby's story, Ariel, is they are articulating this thing that I think is so impossible to like kind of visualize or demonstrate. It's something that like I relate to, but I've not seen depicted in this way so effectively. It's imposter syndrome, right? Yeah. Where he's like, I'm full of bullshit. Like, I'm barely keeping my breakfast down on the plane. Yeah. I'm like getting lucky with these navigational courses. Uh-huh. And now they're all like picking me up on the chair and celebrating me around the room that I got us all home alive. Mm-hmm. Right. And like that cognitive dissonance, that like, I don't believe in myself, but everybody else believes in me and is like elevating me. And now you're the guy in the chair. You got the job. That's terrifying, right?
Yeah.
And so to get like this kind of posthumous attaboy from your best friend, like it's just layers again on top of all of the actual just grief that we can like completely understand, right? Like, it's really powerful and very resonant. And again, like, I keep defending it because I think it's really intentional. Like, I think we're supposed to walk away from episode four really frustrated and like pulling our hair out, mission effing accomplished. Because again, like, I think what they lose in the lack of title cards is like, this is 2 days later, man. Like, Bucky is still like nursing that hangover when he's like back into his plane to fly. Like, so all this stuff is happening very quickly in a really compressed period of time. And then, you know, the other beat of like Crosby to the letter, back to that, him packing up all of his friend's stuff. Yeah. Right. And when you do that interrogation, they're all sitting there like non-confirmed. They don't know what happened. They don't know what happened, but they know what happened to his plane. It exploded. And he shoots like, did you hear me? I said it exploded. So like, that's like cuts both ways, that you don't have the uncertainty. He knows, okay, I got to go pack his stuff up. He's done. He's not going to come walking in 3 days later like I did for him and surprise me. Like, you know.
Yeah, this is like Crosby surviving is the one respite that we get as the viewing audience. Like, everyone else has perished and will continue to perish, unfortunately. And this is like, this is the kindness that the universe and the show has given us. And like, you know, there's a way in which like Crosby almost realizes that himself.
In 10 days, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
With everything you have on your plate, earning your degree online seems impossible. But at Grand Canyon University, we specialize in helping you fit a master's degree in education into your busy day. Your graduation team, led by your own GCU counselor, provides you with the personal support you need to succeed. Achieve your goals with a plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
You mentioned Bucky. He's not doing great. To your point, it would have been really, really helpful to know the time to, but like, and they do within their dialogue kind of address it, but again, I just think it's a little too subtle for my taste. But I do love a drunk Bucky, you know, getting out of the plane. We have Lemons, who we love, of course, and is so good at his job, checking in on Bucky. Clearly he's concerned. He's trying to give him, you know, the kindness. He's trying to show him kindness, rather. And he's like, you know, we're all going to miss Major. I just call him Buck. I don't remember his last name. Egan. I think it's,
I get him mixed up all the time. Buck is Clevin.
Clevin. I'm like, Clevin. Egan is from Severance. Clevin. Thank you.
Buck Clevin and Bucky Buck Clevin. Egan. Thank and you. I keep, yes, getting them incorrect. I apologize.
I just know. So, I mean, I'm accurate, but I'm only accurate to the nicknames. We're all going to miss Buck. And Bucky's like, yeah, whatever. I don't talk about it. I'm going to go home. And then he's like, see you in the morning. But it's like, the sun is already out. It's crazy. This man should not be driving at all.
I know. You really feel that like crazy. He gets in that Jeep, man. And I mean, this was a thing. We saw it in Band of Brothers after the war,
yes,
right? Of like,
oh,
the car.
God, yes.
It is scary, dude. Yeah. But I think, again, it's articulating this notion that we've talked about before of the yo-yo these guys were on, right? I mean, Easy Company is like, they're sitting in their foxholes in Bastogne, like just mired in it until it's over. Yeah. These guys, at 4 o'clock in the morning, they're tucked up asleep in a bed, warm as can be. At 8 o'clock in the morning, they're flying over like Munich, Germany, dropping bombs. And then at 8 o'clock that night, they're in the pub dancing, you know? Yeah. And that's like just such an emotional roller coaster to be on, right? And the way that they have to unpack that. But the effect on Bucky, I mean, this tracks. This is all like historically accurate. Yeah. He makes the call. He talks in code. He gets word.
Put me in, coach. See you tomorrow.
And he races back to the base and is like, dude, I want to fly tomorrow, you know? Yeah. And they send him out on the 10th in this like disastrous mission, you know? And to the changing of the code, even these little beats, Ariel, like some of the interviews I'm hearing about, they keep talking about how like you never saw Bucky Egan without his white sheepskin coat, like that coat that he trades. Yeah. But they started getting crazy superstitious, you know? Yeah. We go back to like the goblin riddle and forget the actual context of it all. The superstition, like the tokens, you know, of Kraz giving Bubbles the little snow globe or whatever it is. That idea that like I'm getting put in the 100th, we're gonna die. It weighed on these guys a lot, dude. Yeah. The notion of like, which plane am I flying? I'm not going in my plane. What do you mean? Like all this stuff, to the extent that he's gotta like change his coat because Buck didn't like this coat.
Like, Buck hated that effing coat. And I'm like, that's actually kind of sweet. You're like, I don't want to wear this anymore. Because there's a way in which like he clearly, when Buck was alive, there was like a defiant level to Bucky where he's just like, yeah, who cares? I'm glad you don't like it. You don't have to like everything that I do. And now it's like he has to look for ways to honor him because his death was just so unthinkable and so quickly and off camera. He's like, I want to just, you know, I want to honor my friend. They get their mission, you know, as we start to get into like the third act of the episode, which is really the mission. The instruction, you know, it's a lot of like vague at this point, I'm feeling like, oh God, another mission. And I think that to this point, and in that way, the show is successful because it just feels like another thing that we're sitting in on, that we're like learning all this information. And there's a way in which just like some of it is going over our heads, some of it is going over their heads, them on the ground there ready to get on these planes. And not to say that they're not focusing or irresponsible, but just to your point, they've been doing this so much, especially recently, that it's like, okay, where are we going now and which place and what do we have to look for? Okay, a train station, just focus on the train station, or like it's really more of like a train terminal. Bad German things happen in the terminal, so we have to bomb it. And then like it's like, okay, we're going and we're all tired. And that's when Bucky exchanges the coat right beforehand. And we're off. There was a way in which like this liftoff was so emotional. It was almost like, I'm trying to put into words now, it's almost like miraculous, it felt like, in the moment.
Yeah.
And this is where the music really started to hit me. Like, there was so much that the music did post lift takeoff, excuse me, liftoff. It's not a freaking rocket. Post takeoff. So many little moments that I'm going to list out in a little bit as we get to them. But like this moment here of like, and I couldn't help but think again, like, wow, this could have been the ending to the fourth episode, but all the emotion, it's almost more worth it to have it here because of everything that they have now all been through and all the losses that they have experienced. This means something. And I was like, holy crap, like, who did they hire a different like music person to do this? And of course, like you said, Crosby has to like remain on the ground, you know, shades of Winters when he gets promoted at some point. He's like, he can no longer be with the people. He has to stand back and like direct. And it's torture for him for sure.
Yeah, it's really wild. I mean, Bucky is almost like the anti-Winters in that he tries to like shirk off his promotion and get back in the plane in the beginning, you know. I'm so with you. When you were talking about the score at the beginning as we sat down here, I was very much thinking of these scenes of the liftoff, of the takeoff. It really is so inspiring, Ariel. Yeah. And I think that, again, like we're getting a little inundated now after 5 hours of Masters of the Air. Some of this stuff is becoming rote to us, but every little bit of this was such a gigantic production. You know, when we rewind, I don't mean to keep going backwards, but to that mission where they got to fly down to Africa. And remember, there were supposed to be three groups and the other groups weren't there. And how come we're not coordinated? They would talk about, like, again, in some of my homework, these planes are loaded down with thousands of pounds of bombs, ammunition, the men, fuel. The plane is always the heaviest at the moment that it's going to take off, right? As soon as you start flying, you're burning fuel out of the wings, you're dropping weight, you're like increasing your fuel efficiency the further you're flying almost, which is fascinating. But it would take them sometimes 2 hours just to reach altitude, to approach their targets. That's and insane. In these musterings, I mean, like this episode, you know, it's a smaller group. They've only got 17. They had started with a group of 35. But when we're coordinating these groups, there's hundreds of planes. It would take them hours to get in the air and in formation, just locked in together. And the Americans, again, because we love these daytime bombing runs, they loved bad weather. These beautiful days, like we see here on October the 10th, it's an effing disaster. One of the things that's like written again and again and again in the book, Masters of Air, there are no foxholes at 30,000 feet. There's just nowhere to hide. There is no safe place on that plane, right? As much as like the Luftwaffe has started to identify these frontal attacks being like nightmarishly devastating, and they are.
Right.
You know, the plane is like a death chamber, man, and there's just nowhere to hide from them. So, yeah, the liftoff was like huge and felt very epic and heroic and inspirational. And just to talk about the other little beat here with Bucky in the like pre-mission, they're sitting in the room and we have somebody beginning to question, wait, who are we dropping these bombs on? We're dropping it on a neighborhood around the train station.
Yes.
There's a church right there. It's Sunday morning. We're going to be flying in at 10 o'clock. Everybody's coming out of the church. And this was part of, it was a big thing with the RAF, right? Hitler had promised the Germans, we will devastate Europe. They will never bomb us. They're never going to come to Germany. And there was a little bit of like a gentleman's agreement where they were very focused on military targets through the early bombing campaigns. But there's a point where I believe a Luftwaffe flight gets lost. They get misoriented and they end up bombing the hell out of this British city. And Churchill's like, uh-uh. And that begins this onslaught from the British that is still talked about like controversially today in terms of the loss of human life and like civilian populations being devastated. But it comes to the reality of what we're talking about here, which is that you're dropping bombs from 40,000 feet. Like, as accurate as that bomb site is, you know, you're in flak, you're dealing with like with other dogfighters, like it's a bit of a disaster. And a lot of civilians were killed through the bombing campaign. And there was this strong, strong belief from America that this was not going to win the war, but it was going to truncate the amount of time we had to fight, right? Yeah. That you could like break the German supply lines.
We don't want to be the British and be at this 4 years from now. Let's end this.
It's true. But I mean, then you come to this period, this Black Week, this 10-day run, and the Luftwaffe gets a definitive advantage. I mean, they really F us up here. And it won't be until like the beginning of the next year as we roll into like 44 that we start to like get ourselves together and the Mustangs get over there. But Bucky's response to this guy who is raising these issues of like, look, dude, it's war. You know, it's better them than every guy that you know. And that's the reality of it, right? Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, it came down to this very us or them thing. Yeah. But I think that at this point in the campaign, a lot of the pilots, a lot of the soldiers in these bombers were starting to really look at what they were doing and question what they were doing and the morality of it, you know?
No, I love that us or them thing that you're mentioning, because that's something that all three of these miniseries have in common, right? And obviously you can extrapolate that out further just to war in general. That's kind of at some point that's what it comes down to. And it starts for the people on the ground or in the air or what have you, the people who are like doing the fighting themselves. At some point, all the, you know, rhetoric, it kind of goes out the window, and it's just like, I'm the one that's here, and the people who are making these decisions couldn't be any further away, so we have to find our own reasons for doing things. This nightmarish attack that comes upon them, this moment where the music just stops. This is again one of those moments where I like it, like took my breath away. The music stops and you just see like the I don't know what they're called, not vapor trails, like engine trails, smoke trails from
the plane. I think they call them contrails, is right. The technical term.
Chemtrails to some people. The way that they're just, you see this thing distantly in the sky from the perspective of one of our ships, one of our planes, and then you see them coming down and the music stops and you're like, wait, is that what I think it is? Because it looks so peaceful in a way and so not harmful. And then once you realize what's actually happening and then the music changes, I just thought it was so perfectly executed. The like the calm before the storm, right? Like the calm before the awful, horrific carnage that was about to come. And like clearly their tactics had changed, like you keep referring to, which I think is fascinating. I think at some point they realized they're always bombing in the daylight. Maybe we should do something about that and like change the way because we can see them always. Anyway, that moment, there's another moment where like they do this slow motion activation between the planes.
Yeah, that was a great shot. Yes.
I was like, this is incredible. This is so, like, it feels insensitive or disrespectful almost to say that it looks cool, but it just it felt so grand. And it felt like this is the kind of stuff that I was hoping the show would give us. And I'm so happy to watch it now, like, earn it in a way in this episode.
I'm like hyper cognizant of like, I come on here and I get really excited to talk about this stuff. I mean, like, I'm a kid that grew up playing with G.I. Joe's aerial, you know, like we're boys. That ball turret is cool. It's just cool. It's a cool thing, man. It's cool. But I mean, the practicality of what we're talking about, like, grounds us out a little bit, but that's a stunning shot. Like the B-17s at speed were somewhere around 200 miles an hour. They could get going faster, but that's like roughly their like cruising speed. Those Focke-Wulf 190s that I was talking about a couple of weeks ago that are really starting to like devastate us. Mm-hmm. And so again, just to talk about like that moment, these are like jet levels of speed. Like you're talking about a 600 mile per hour passing speed, right? And the way that they slow it down to give us that shot of Rosenthal making eye contact with the other pilot.
Yeah.
It's just like one of those few moments, because the reality is like, they could see that, you know, they could see these other pilots ripping past the cockpits and stuff. There's a couple of crazy stories I'll get to as we get further, but it's fascinating. And it is, look, man, dogfights are cool, right? Like some of this stuff is cool. There's a reason that like it makes it as a dramatic television show alongside all of like the weight of the actual history, right? And the loss of human life. We're not trying to like ignore that. And just to put like an asterisk on like some of what I'm talking about there, part of the thing with the Americans and why we were so fixated on these daytime bombing runs is because we were really obsessed with strategic targets. Right. I don't want to like whitewash the US's role or like the number of casualties that we've incited, but from command, there was a very intentional, no, we are not going to focus on civilian centers. We're looking for like military strategically important sites, right? Yeah. I mean, ultimately, we bombed a lot of houses. We bombed a lot of residential places because like it was messy, you know. This was not like as easy as anybody really thought it was, you know?
No. European architecture would like a word. As we get into the last few beats here, this is what we've been talking about the whole time. Like, we watch these planes, and there is a way, again, to the show's credit, we've seen so many battles at this point that to watch, and we've seen a lot of people go down, a lot of people, you know, both not have time to get out of their planes, yes, have time to parachute off their planes. This, we get a little bit of both, but like the monumental loss of the aircraft just feels, it's insane. And then we get the one plane. They're like, does anybody see any other plane from the 100th? Is there anybody else around us? It's crazy. And that's right around the same time that we, and this is like another, this is really the last one, because we already talked about Crosby with the letter at the very end of the episode. The last moment that I was like, holy crap, this is incredible. Just like the huge floating pieces of debris that are falling all around the sky. And I remember the first moment, I'm like, what is that? And then I'm like, oh, shit. And then there's just so much of it. And they're trying to find, it has basically become like a graveyard in the sky. And they are trying to look for signs of life. They're trying to see if people have parachuted out of their planes. They're trying to see if anyone has survived. And it's like, no, it seems like it might just be us. And like, that feels so different from what we've seen before. It just, it's a completely different reality.
To invoke the words of like one of our favorite co-hosts and Grace Leader, like, let the show tell you how to watch it, you know. And to a degree, we've become proficient in like understanding a little bit more of what's going on in the air, right? That like lull in the storm where like Rosie starts humming, you know, after the like fighters come in, and there's that little bit of a gap, and like, because it was almost like, I don't know if you're a Battlestar Galactica fan, but like that episode one, like 33, like they would make passes, these Focke wolves would come in, and it would take 4 minutes.
I just got chills.
To circle around to come back again. So there's this perpetual up and down of like, here they come. Okay, 800 yards, open up, right? Mm-hmm. And the weight of understanding that scene of the debris falling everywhere. I mean, it's like staggering. And again, like, we just are introduced to him this episode. We're gonna track his story as far as it goes through Masters of Air. But Rosie Rosenthal is the sole survivor, the pilot of this last plane that makes it back. This is his first mission. He's a really fascinating character. He's a Jewish kid from New York. He was a lawyer, had just gotten his degree, and started his first day at like a brand new job at like a prestigious New York law firm. Pearl Harbor happens. He's a Pearl Harbor Monday guy. He goes and signs up immediately. Yeah. And he would go on to write highly detailed accountings of every single mission that he participated in. Wow. So he has become like an incredible resource of history for us to go back to, because of like the chaos and the lack of clarity so many of these guys had. There was just, the records were only so good, even despite the kind of formal interrogations that we've seen.
Yeah.
So Rosenthal made it his mission to remember.
That's so fascinating.
You know, I don't know. It's heavy to me. And it really, like, he's like looked back on, we'll talk about him a lot as we go forward more, right. But like, he notoriously gets off this first flight and is like, are they all like that? Like, are they all that rough? You know, and the fact that he makes the effort, it makes a difference, I think. You know?
No, it absolutely makes a difference. And it's so beautiful to learn that part of it, of like how good he gets at it, because it makes so much sense that his first mission, they all sit down at the end of the episode and they're like, what about this plane? No record. What about that plane? No record. And he's probably sitting there thinking, like, how could it be like this? Like, how? And it's literally like probably the worst day of losses, or part of a string of the worst day of losses that they had ever had. So obviously, you know, the circumstances are a little bit different. But the fact that that would, instead of send him in some negative direction, empowers him to be the change and be the one, in a way that, like, we saw Crosby really fight to be early on, when he was like, no, it's important. When did they go down? So, like, we see that Rosenthal is a Crosby-like person in that sense, that he cares about these important things and cares about these people. And that's a good sign.
I love it, you know, because Buck and Bucky, as our leaders in the beginning, these were guys who signed up like before Pearl Harbor, right? Again, they were like heroes as the dudes are showing up already. They already have this like gigantic reputation. And so now we get to meet Rosenthal, see him on his first flight and track it. There's a great letter was written by a guy, de Blasio was his tail gunner in the plane that day. Okay. And it was published posthumously that he had like kind of sent to Rosenthal, and Rosenthal like sends it to the Air and Space Museum after de Blasio passes in like 2001, and he talks about that experience, you know, about like watching the other planes falling out of the air, the moments, the like 4 minutes that they have waiting for the Focke-Wulfs to circle around, the like rosy maneuvering again, like these, they were locked in formation and these dudes were terrified of flak, because when the flak's going off there was nothing they could do. You got nine guys in the plane who have no control. They would say that we talked about it last time, but that beat of like, you're flak happy, no, you're flak happy.
Tell me if I'm you're flak happy.
Flak happy, apparently, Ariel, is like a term that they applied to PTSD, right? Like that they didn't have the language for. Wow. It's the thing we talked about. And some of these guys would get so crazed, they just would start shooting their machine guns at the flak in the air because like they had to do something.
Right.
They could at least do
so
something.
So much powerlessness that your body and your brain will like accept. Yeah.
So I just think like you go into that beat and you watch Rosenthal maneuvering these planes, this big hulking B-17. That is like just a slug getting chased around. I'm thinking of like headless chickens and sleek weasels for any Survivor Gabon fans out there. But like, you know, they're so outmaneuvered, and Rosenthal like very succinctly keeps these guys alive, right? Yeah. Through like his maneuvering, just being a goddamn good pilot. Yeah. And they land, and de Blasio writes in his letter, I don't remember a lot of it. My memory is taking hits. He says, it's been 7 years since I've had a flashback. Maybe they're gone for good now. Jesus. But I remember stepping off that plane and just vomiting until like I couldn't move anymore. And you like helping me get on the truck to go to interrogation. Like, you know, the reflection of these moments, like, just to circle it back, we've seen a lot of dogfights, we've seen a lot of bombing runs and missions at this point, but I feel this one, Ariel.
Yeah.
And I feel like all our frustrations around episode 4, I have some of them, if not alleviated, at least like articulated to a degree that I'm satisfied with.
For sure.
Like episode 5 made episode 4 better. And that makes me
for
happy coming away from it.
You know? And in a way, like almost... like any good follow-up season or follow-up episode like makes it not just better in retrospect, in some ways like, oh God, that shouldn't have been that bad. But like also it makes it more important. Like it makes it feel like a more important necessary step, even if the execution could have been a little bit different. And then, you know, we get the crazy moment where it's just the one ship, like we keep saying, the one plane coming down. They get a plane that isn't even part of the 100th coming down, and there's like a false like alarm as far as like them being a survivor. And then ultimately at the end of the episode, we get the beautiful, beautiful, heartbreaking, lovely moment of basically, like you put it, Crosby reading his own obituary. And that's that's where the episode ends. Anything else you want to say about the episode?
Not really. I think this was a really good one. I really liked it. You know, I started by saying like it seemed pretty straightforward, and I think it was, but I think like it's executing on all the setup that the first four episodes built for us. So I come away from five really liking it and really eager to see what six looks like.
We should be so lucky. What a time. What a time. I can't believe we've landed back here again. We're always landing in a different place. Now we find ourselves in a different, in another other different place that actually has cold beer, unlike the false promise that they had when they landed in North Africa.
Yeah, really. Look at us.
So yeah, well, we'll be back. Yes, look at us. And you'll be back looking at us next week when we return for part six for the final four. Oh my God, fire making. Final four episodes of Masters of the Air. Rich, until then, what else have you got going on?
You can hit me up, twitch.tv/DM Philly. I promise I'll be doing some stuff over there again soon. The YouTube VODs for all my old D&D games are there. I'm talking about Halo Season 2 with the great Corey B. So that's happening around here. And then I guess go give me a follow on Twitter at DM Philly. Keep up with what I got going on out there.
You better do all of that.
Yeah.
I am on Twitter at that other Ariel. I'm covering movies every week with the aforementioned Grace, Pusher Recaps Theater, and covering 6 Feet Under, another show that I really love with Dr. Amanda. We are almost about halfway with season two, speaking of halfway marks. So follow along with that if that interests you. That's it from us for this week. Like you said, we'll be back next week with part six. Until then, bye-bye.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.